And so today we continue exploring the Sermon on the Mount, the series of lessons that have been called the heart of Jesus' teachings and the heart of Christianity. In Matthew, Jesus delivers these lessons to his small band of disciples. I think a lot of great teachers decide to train their staff first, right? So he trains his disciples and teaches them the things that he later will be imparting to the multitudes. And really, by the time he really brings this out to the multitudes, his disciples have a greater understanding of what's going on. Just the beloved 12. Just picture the beloved 12 on the top of that summit, overlooking the Sea of Galilee, taking in Jesus' words. And our sources today are sources we've used before: The Secret According to Jesus by Ed Townley, Reverend Ed Townley, the Bible scholar, and Emmett Fox, The Sermon on the Mount. Now, many of you will remember that Matthew's central purpose throughout his entire gospel is to convince his fellow Jews that Jesus is the Messiah prophesied in the Old Testament. And we've already heard Jesus tell his disciples that he comes not to destroy the laws of Moses, but to do what? To fulfill them. That's right, to fulfill them. And remember, those original Ten Commandments were about a lot of behaviors and thou shalt not. Thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not steal, and so on. The old law focuses on external, lower states of consciousness, while Jesus' mountaintop teachings carry humankind forward and upward to the next great step, the idea that outward acts, rules, and rituals are not enough. As Emmett Fox writes, the inner person must also be changed in order to enter the kingdom of heaven. So, teaching his disciples, Jesus uses a format of, you have heard it said, referring back to the old law, but I say to you. And last week we looked at the first of these teachings in Matthew, verses 21 to 22. You have heard it said, thou shalt not kill. But I say to you, whoever is hungry with his brother shall be in danger of judgment. Notice Jesus is not nullifying the old commandment. He is simply taking it to a higher level. It's not about those outer acts. It's about inner consciousness. We are here not just to refrain from killing people. That's a low bar, right? We are here to express the love of the divine and behold the Christ in ourselves and all others. So Jesus continues. He says, therefore, if you bring your gift to the altar and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go your way. First, be reconciled to your brother and then come and offer your gift. Now, it was the custom at the time to place gifts on the altar: grain offerings, unleavened bread, small doves, and larger animals even, like cows and bulls. Here Jesus is saying, I believe, your gift will not be acceptable, meaning it will not have meaning until you make peace with your brother. This teaching reminds me of a story I think we've talked about before about Leonardo da Vinci while he was painting The Last Supper. And he was working on the face of Jesus at the time that he had a bitter disagreement with a fellow painter. And this led to great discord and hatred between the two. So da Vinci used live models, actually, for the disciples and for Jesus. And he got all the disciples right, but for some reason, he could not get Jesus' face right. He tried and tried and tried. And finally, after many attempts, it just occurred to him that he was not able to paint Jesus' face because he was holding such hatred in his heart for his fellow painter. So he did forgive his painter. I'm not sure whether they actually reconciled or not, but he forgave the painter. And that very night, Jesus' entire face came to him in a dream, and he was able to finish his masterpiece. Now, honestly, I don't know if that story's true or not, but I do know it holds great truths about the fact that we can block that divine flow by what we hold in our hearts and minds. And that's, I think that's the point of the story. So, let's see, moving on here. The point is that Da Vinci was just not in the right consciousness to do sacred work. Finally, after he forgave his enemy and went on, he opened his own soul to that flow. He really had to clear away the negative energy before he could create. And Jesus, I believe, is telling us that if we hold resentment and hatred in any relationship, we have to resolve those feelings before we can truly express our many gifts. Just going through the motions of bringing the gift to the altar will not dissolve the negative energies of our outer conflicts of our lives. And remember, in the last two that we looked at, two teachings, Jesus has cautioned against holding anger or being in conflict with a brother. So the question is, there's Da Vinci. The question is, who is my brother? Who is my sister? Charles Fillmore, our UNI co-founder, defines brotherhood as an established thought in high consciousness. This thought springs from the understanding that God is the one Father, and therefore we are all brothers and sisters. Because we are individualized expressions of the same God, we are all one. Jesus explains this poignantly in what Ed Townley calls one of the greatest short stories ever told, the parable of the Good Samaritan in Luke. You might remember that Jesus tells this parable right after he has taught, "Love your neighbor as yourself." And a lawyer asked him, "But who is my neighbor?" Jesus then responds by telling the story of a lone traveler traveling from the road of Jericho to Jerusalem, and he comes upon a man. There's a man lying on the road, and the man has been attacked by robbers, beaten, and left for dead. So actually there are three travelers. First, a Levite and a priest come along, and they see the man lying on the road, and they realize that he's either dead or about to be dead, and they cross the road to the other side. Next, a Samaritan comes along, and he has much more compassion for the man. Not only does he help him give him immediate first aid, but he takes him to an inn and pays the innkeeper 2 denarii to take care of him while the traveler is gone. And that would have been the equivalent today of about 2 days' wages. So then Jesus ends this little parable by asking those present, "I ask you, who has a greater sense of their neighbor? Who is the man who proved who the neighbor was?" Now that seems like a no-brainer to us today, doesn't it? I mean, we can immediately see what the answer is. But in Jesus' day, it would have been a little harder, because in the day, absolutely, priests and Levites were men of great power and authority. And according to the purity codes of the day, there would have been grave consequences for them helping the man in need, because they were strictly forbidden to come in contact with blood or any body fluids or dead bodies. In fact, doing so would deem them impure and therefore unable to perform their spiritual duties. So they must have thought by avoiding the whole thing, they were serving God. They were doing what they were required to do. But the irony of this parable would not have been lost on Jesus' other listeners. At the time, there was bitter hatred between the Jews and the Samaritans, going all the way back to the time of the Babylonian exile. The Samaritans were descendants of peasants left behind during the exile, and they were left behind because it was thought that they were too unworthy to come along. So they ended up intermarrying other non-Jewish people, making them even more impure and unworthy in the eyes of Orthodox Jews. The Samaritans were social outcasts. In fact, it was strictly forbidden to have any association with them. This is religious law now. Jews were not even allowed to speak to a Samaritan. So the Samaritan in Jesus' story, a victim of oppression himself, great oppression, is the only one willing to stop and help the man. And Jesus, the master teacher, poses that perfect question, forcing the lawyer to admit that it is the Samaritan who disregards the letter of the law, but fulfills a greater spiritual law, and that is the law of spiritual love, the spiritual law of love. Now, certainly the literal moral of this story is the understanding that all of us are neighbors, all men and women, all humankind, and we deserve full love and acceptance, two of our core values. Later in the sermon, Jesus does ask the compelling question, for if you love only those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? So as we move beyond the literal meaning of the story into the metaphysical, into bringing it to a personal interpretation, we ask ourselves, what can I learn from this story, from this parable, about my own soul's unfoldment? And so we have to ask ourselves, I believe, are there individuals or even whole groups of people whom I fail to recognize, in whom I fail to recognize the Christ, in whom I fail to recognize their spiritual essence? Often we judge others based on superficial differences or society norms instead of, as our song said this morning, beholding the Christ in them. Maybe Jesus calls us to ask, who are the Samaritans in our own consciousness? Those who look different, those of different races, different cultures, different religions, those who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender, immigrants, the elderly, the poor. Any time and in any way we see our fellow human beings as less than and separate, we are failing to recognize their and our own true Christ essence. Charles Fillmore wrote that the Good Samaritan represents the Christ in you who is able to see the Christ in all others. And Ed Townley, Bible scholar Ed Townley, says, any unresolved issues with others will negatively affect our prayer lives, our healing, and our own empowerment. The gift on the altar must be free of the negative energy of judgment and resentment. It must reflect a sense of love and peace. The love of God must express outward from the center of our hearts with no blocks or distortions. Be clear, God never puts up the distortion, but we sometimes can. Our altar is our own consciousness, and our offerings are our attitudes, our prayers, and our service. And when we are at peace with ourselves, we bring to the altar of our own consciousness of divinity, really, a gift unclouded by anger or resentment. And then we align ourselves with the infinite love and contribute to the manifestation of the kingdom of heaven. And next, Jesus follows up by saying, come to terms quickly with your accuser. Some versions, like this one, say with your adversary. Come to terms quickly while you are still on the way to court with him, or your accuser may hand you over to the judge, and the judge to the guard, and you will be thrown into prison. Truly I tell you, you will never get out until you have paid the last penny. Now today, when courts and trials are so much a part of our culture and our class group consciousness, really, this teaching seems a little hard to understand. However, in Jesus' days, laws governing debtors were really very severe. The debtor was very better off to come to terms with his accuser or her accuser quickly before the debt escalated and court costs were added, or the person was thrown in prison and then could never pay off the debt. But metaphysically, this teaching seems to be just another illustration of one of Jesus' main messages in the Sermon on the Mount, to love your neighbor as yourself. And so to be in hostility, to be in conflict with another human being, is in violation of what Jesus says is the greatest commandment. At one level, Jesus advocates that we come to agreement with our accusers, our outer accusers, our adversaries quickly, and try to resolve our differences. Yet this is another example of Jesus, the great teacher, using parable and metaphor to clarify a point. Jesus is not just talking about lawsuits here, and he's not just talking about people in our outer lives. He is using those images to symbolize events in our consciousness. We all have an accuser, and guess where that accuser resides? Anybody? Within, that's exactly right, in our own hearts, our own minds, not in our hearts, but in our minds. Our accuser, we might say, is that eternal, internal voice, that negative self-talk that tells us we are limited and we are unworthy. And be careful how you talk to yourself, because you are listening. So, how do we come to terms with that internal voice? How do we settle matters quickly? Ed Townley tells us that if we try to resist or argue with that voice, which might be our immediate human reaction, we are simply giving it strength and power and credence, and we are just stirring up negative thought energy. In doing so, we allow the accuser in our consciousness to establish the terms of the debate, and we cannot win. The judge will always rule against us, and we will always be held prisoner in lack and limitation. Remember, thoughts held in mind reproduce their own kind where? In our consciousness, in mind. That's exactly right. So the original problem that you have, whatever it is, becomes magnified many times by our wrong thinking concerning it. So what is the alternative? Well, later Jesus will say, resist not evil, but turn the other cheek. Now, metaphysically, this means to give back a different form of energy. To come to terms with our accuser is to turn away from thoughts of limitation to the truth with a capital T. To enfold in love and light every negative accusation, gently dissolving mistaken thoughts in the light of our true divine identity. Emmett Fox gives us a great example. He says, maybe this happened to some of us, imagine waking up one morning and just sneezing and coughing and feeling miserable. You say to yourself, oh great, now I have a cold. It'll probably last for days, and I won't do well on my presentation this week at work, and then I might even lose my job, and then my family will starve. Anybody ever spin out like that? We dwell on the thought, in this case, of having a cold, and on all the inconvenience and misery it's going to bring into our lives. We might spend energy here trying to figure out how I got this cold. Maybe from an open window on Monday. Maybe from that colleague who came to work sick and sat by me and breathed on me on Tuesday. We think of all these various causes. We think of various remedies, all useless, all that did not work in the past. Then we start to project about how long the cold will last and how long we're going to be sick with it. And what are we doing? By the time we get to this point, we have amplified the condition so strongly that we have allowed it to overcome us. We are the cold. We've claimed the cold. And it is dug into our consciousness in such a degree that getting rid of it is going to be a little more difficult. Instead, we can turn the other cheek. With the very first sneeze, we gently deny the power of the condition and affirm the truth. We say, this is a temporary condition and it has no power over me. I claim divine wholeness now. And Emmett Fox reminds us that any worldly condition can be treated this way. Family relationship issues, business difficulty, prosperity problems, anything. And let's just remember, this is not hocus pocus. It works because as spiritual beings having a human experience, we dwell in two realms. Instead of spending all of our energy struggling with outer issues in the physical relative realm, or trying to resist that error thinking, have a fight with it in our heads, we can come to terms with our internal accuser and align ourselves with all the purity and power of divine ideas that are always, always there for us to use. Ideas of wholeness, harmony, and life, all in the absolute realm, all from the Christ within. And in this consciousness, we know that any condition in the relative realm has the potential to be healed and transformed. And so we're going to continue exploring Jesus' lessons from the Sermon on the Mount in the weeks ahead. But for now, let's just remember that in all these lessons, Jesus assures us that living our lives from our divine nature is all about what we hold in consciousness. Certainly our behavior is important, but our thoughts are more important. They produce our behavior. Ed Townley writes, "The law that is God in expression in the universe works not from our heads, but from our hearts. And it operates only when we are clear, unencumbered, and centered in the energy of perfect divine love. In every life situation, when we focus on the infinite possibilities of the love we are, our Christ light shines in us and through us, creating the kingdom of heaven on this earth." And that is what Jesus considers to be the new law. And so it is. So let's take a moment now just to affirm the great truth about the divine that makes all of this possible. And for those of you who are here for the first time, this is printed in your bulletin. This is being said in Unity churches all over the world this morning, that there is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life: God, the good, omnipotent, and so it is. Together, there is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life: God, the good, omnipotent, and so it is.